This is an Enterprise Times podcast. I'm here with Jeetu Patel, Chief Product Officer of Box. Hi, Jeetu.
Good to see you. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. You did a webinar recently. You spoke about how Box looks at innovation, and you say you follow megatrends. And I think you talked about cloud, mobile, and AI. Could you just tell me a little bit about that and how your approach to actually doing that, the innovation within Box?
Yeah, if you think of how do you create long-lasting, sustaining companies, one of the things to think about over there is how are they making sure that they're always staying ahead of the market? And one way to definitively stay ahead of the market is not fight the market when something massive is happening. So if there's a movement that's going on, you should actually figure out where that movement is early on, which is what we call megatrends, and then make sure that you can have those act as tailwinds for you rather than headwinds. So in our history, we've actually had three of these megatrends that have been massively instructive for us over the course of the past 14 years. The first one was the move to the cloud. Today, it's not at all counterintuitive when people say, well, most of the workloads are going to go to the cloud. But 15 years ago, there was a very small subset of people that believed that that was going to happen. But it was abundantly obvious to the company that that's where we should go out and place our strategic bet. The second big move that happened, and these started to compound on top of each other, the second big move that happened was the move to mobile with smartphones and all of that. We used that combined with the cloud to go out and enable things in a very, very differentiated way compared to what anyone else would. And then the third one now that we're going through is artificial intelligence, where the way in which you interact with content in the next 5 years will be materially different than the way that you've interacted with it over the past 20.
I know the answer to this question is probably obvious, but can you talk briefly on how those megatrends impacted the Box product at those different points in time?
Yeah, the cloud and mobile were pretty close to each other when they started happening, because one of the key assumptions that we have in how we build products is if you don't think you can deliver something that's 10x better than what's already existing in the market, then don't bother doing it, because a 20% improvement on something is not enough for people to actually be motivated to switch over to you. So you have to have a discontinuous level of innovation that's done so that people can find the motivation to do that. We use this 10x rule internally in product quite a bit. One of the 10x things that we did over there was it was so hard for people to share information outside of organizational boundaries. But oftentimes, you were starting to see that the boundaries between your employees and people that you worked with closely outside of your company were blurring. So there are times when I might work with a contractor much closer than I do with my internal employees, and I wanted to just share the data easily. Cloud and mobile really helped us do that in a very easy way that was actually not possible before that. Let me give you a little bit more of detail on that. So if you move to the cloud and have a multi-tenancy model in the cloud, there was basically a global identity. I could say, I want to share something with Kathy, who's a supplier, and as a result of that, I'm going to just go ahead and share a folder. Kathy doesn't happen to have a Box license, but I do. And so I shared something with Kathy. Kathy doesn't have a Box license. She just goes on her website, downloads a free license, and then she just accepts the share. All I needed was her email to share something, which is a global unique identifier. Contrast that with the non-cloud world and how you would do it. Well, you would have to first punch a hole through the firewall. You then have to say, I'm going to provision a user account for Kathy, who's at a different company than the company that I'm at. You have to provision an account in your Active Directory instance. 2 months later, Kathy gets a different job. You have to now figure out a way to deprovision that. It just becomes a hot mess pretty fast. Do this at scale at hundreds of thousands of employees, it just wouldn't work. For us, that was the discontinuous lever that actually got created. Someone could be on their mobile device, got a share, accepts the share, downloads the new client, and boom, you're up and running and in business. And the two of us are now communicating as though we're sitting right next to each other. And that was magical for people. That wouldn't have happened without cloud and mobile coming together as architectural constructs. The example I give is imagine if Amazon was built before the postal service came about, before the airline infrastructure came about, and the railroad infrastructure came about. You literally would not have that company succeed at going out and selling books. You needed a baseline of infrastructure to build on top of. And what we had was cloud and mobile became that baseline of infrastructure on top of which we built. And now we're in the next phase where you start talking about AI. How do you get more meaning from your content? If you didn't have the AI infrastructure, we wouldn't be able to do the next wave of what we're doing without it.
I get your example in terms of cloud, but I don't see where mobile fits in that.
Mobile was people are on the move. They actually want to make sure that they can get all of their access to all of the content on their mobile device. Imagine how difficult it is to get terabytes and terabytes of data that you might have access to in a company be made available to you when you're on the road by just opening your phone. Like today, if I have a laptop with me when I travel to the UK, but I've probably spent about 2.5 hours on my laptop this trip, and I've spent most of the time on my phone. And most of the time I've spent on my phone is reviewing documents, approving press releases. We had a major announcement while I was here to approve that press release before it went out. All of those things happened on my phone with Box. Wouldn't have been able to do that if mobile wasn't a big wave.
Before we move on to AI, what you've talked about has quite a few layers of complexity around things like compliance as well. How difficult is it to build that level of complexity, and what are the different real complications within it?
We happen to be in a business which is not easy to replicate and very boring for other people to go out and build. And those are typically good businesses to be in. Most companies don't want to be content management companies, and being a content management company is a long game. In 13 years, we started with a basic content management collaboration workflow infrastructure. And then around that, we then added security, compliance, privacy, data protection, all of those pieces around the content. We figured out that, hey, when customers buy our product, they are also looking for encryption of data. Okay, so what do you do with encryption of data? Well, you need to make sure you manage your own encryption key. So we built a product called KeySafe. When customers buy our product, they also were looking for how do you make sure that there's retention and disposition of data and legal holds for e-discovery purposes. So we actually created a product called Box Governance. We created a product for Box Zones because the UK wanted their data to be stored in region rather than within the US. So we actually created a product that allowed you to have the storage in country. All of those capabilities have just continued to keep adding more value. But security, data protection, compliance is what we think about that as a P0 requirement. That is what gives us the permission to even have the conversation with the customer, that an enterprise intellectual property, that piece of intellectual property can be put into the cloud where we have the privilege of being a customer's custodian. We wouldn't even have that if that weren't the case.
And it also helps deliver that high cost of entry for new entrants as well, doesn't it?
It's not an easy thing to do. So here's an interesting dynamic. When we first came out with the cloud, initially, people were very skeptical. They said, well, any good idea that becomes mainstream at some point in time in its origination just seemed like an absurd idea. Ours was no different on that front. And so when we first came out an offering in the cloud, people were very skeptical of moving the data in the cloud because of security and compliance and data protection and privacy reasons. Today, what we find is increasingly the industries that were the most conservative are the ones that are the most accelerated in their move of the most sensitive data to the cloud first. So when they come on board with us, if a financial services company comes on board with us, they take the most sensitive workloads and move it over to us first because they feel like the security posture of the cloud is safer than that it is on-prem. And if you look at most CEOs that have gotten fired, it's either because of sexual harassment or because of a data breach. We can solve one of those problems for them. That's how we think about it.
The third megatrend you spoke about was AI. How is that now impacting things?
The thing about AI that got really interesting was this very disturbing characteristic of our industry, which is the more you use content management systems, the harder they get to use. And that just doesn't seem like the world should be that way. In most software products, the more you use them, the easier they get to use. But the reason it gets harder for us to use is because you have a lot of content that gets concentrated in Box. And the more content that gets concentrated in Box, the harder it is to find, not just in Box, in any system. And so we started thinking about this problem going, how do we solve this problem so that the more you use the system, the not only does it get easier to use, but the more valuable any piece of content gets over time. So we wanted to continue to be able to provide a compounding value of content the longer it stays in Box. We started looking at this, and the big area where you can actually add a lot of value is by adding intelligence to content. And the way that you add intelligence in the content management space is you have this thing called metadata, which is data about data that actually describes data. For example, if I have a contract, I know that what the contract amount is, who the contract is for, what the contract expiration date is, so on and so forth. And those all become metadata elements of that piece of content, that file. When we were thinking about that, we were like, well, one of the challenges with metadata is that, yes, it has to operate at scale and the scalability. We solved that problem because every 3.5 years, we scale our infrastructure 10x. We're doubling our storage every year in our system. So like we always had the scale ethos in our company. One of the things about scale was most of the metadata systems don't work well because the accuracy of the metadata inside the system is not that great. The reason for the inaccuracy is because most people don't bother putting metadata in the system. It's just too tedious to do. So how do you solve this problem? Well, you could solve this problem if there were some way for the system to be smart enough to know what a piece of content was about and automatically populate the metadata. That would be pretty cool to do. Well, it so happens that tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions, are being spent on artificial intelligence where you're doing very sophisticated models for AI on different classes of content, whether it be identifying an object from an image or tagging the location of an image or making sure that you can identify what the meaning of a paragraph is or identifying what the contract amount is, whatever those might be. And so what we said is, let's partner up with these AI vendors, provide some kind of mechanism or a framework that can allow other providers to start adding value to content that's in Box. Because we have the unique privilege of being custodians of intellectual property of customers. And if they wanted to make sure they enhance the value of that intellectual property, we should give them a mechanism to do that. That's why we launched this product called Box Skills, which allows you to then tap into all the innovation that's happening in AI. Going back to our original point, when you identify a megatrend like artificial intelligence and use it as a tailwind to say, I'm going to make sure that the billions of dollars that are being spent on AI, I can take advantage of that rather than fighting it. Oftentimes what people do is they'll say, well, I'm going to build my own AI engine. Well, there's billions being spent on it. We've got a lot of content. An AI model is only as good as the data set that it can get trained against. We've got private data sets from customers, and if the customers want to make sure that they can actually make use of those artificial intelligence modules, then we should be able to do that. The one thing that was very clear to us was, we are mere custodians of the data. We are not confused about the fact that our customers own their data. The defaults that we pick and the options that we give to customers are, if you want to use artificial intelligence on your content to automatically populate metadata, we will give you a mechanism to do it. But it's not something that we're going to do for any other reason besides give you an on-ramp so that you can make that happen.
What you've done at that point is make a decision to deliver a value to customer, but not necessarily have a competitive advantage for yourself that can't be replicated by other people.
Ah, that's really an interesting point you bring up. This is a common misconception. The reality is artificial intelligence is in its very early days. And if you look at one of the big downfalls of enterprise software from a customer standpoint is they get locked into technology too soon. And then once you get locked in, you can't move out and then beholden to that one. So what we've tried to do is say, today, Google might be really good at certain algorithms and AI models that they've built. And tomorrow, Microsoft comes out a little bit further ahead. And then the day after, IBM does something a little bit better. And you don't really know at this stage in the game who to bet on. What you do know is that all of your content is getting standardized in a system of record called Box. What you want to do is make sure that regardless of who is best in class over there can actually bring that value to us. And then what we do with that content is we actually are able to bring that metadata into life in some very unique experiences so that you can have better search and discovery. You can trigger workflows in a more easy manner. You can make sure that security and anomaly detection can be detected. All of those pieces, you can have better classification of content. Once you have classification, can you apply policies of content in the right way? So all of those pieces are unique value adds that we can provide. But the core linchpin is make sure that you can take advantage of the AI module. So that's one area that we've invested a lot in AI is Box Skills, which is using the market's machine learning algorithms and giving customers an accelerant and not having them to bet on a particular AI vendor. There is a second area of AI investments that we're making, which is this thing called Box Graph. And Box Graph is essentially the underlying infrastructure that we have that does a very unique job of understanding the relationship between two pieces of content and content and people or people and people. So for example, we then, powered by Box Graph, are building a product called Box Shield, which is a security product that can detect anomalies and increase the visibility that an IT security administrator can have on behavior that's actually happening within your system. So for example, if G2 accesses a document from New York City and literally 35 minutes later, he's accessing the document from the UK, that seems like it's an impossible travel scenario and probably should be flagged and then automatically be brought up to the IT security administrator that, hey, this seems like an anomaly. And then we actually surface those anomalies to them in a visible dashboard. That is actually being powered by our own AI algorithm called Box Graph. So those are the two investments we're making.
Briefly, in terms of Box Graph, that sounds like it's graph database technology where you're linking two data points together. The obvious next step from that is where graph databases add additional values to enable customers to link any data points together within it. You basically mentioned a couple, but is that where you're looking to take that product?
That's where you'll see that go over time. And right now we've seen the graph is powering a bunch of different areas. If you say, what is the single thing that the Box obsesses the most about? It's identify problems that are really painful for customers and make sure that you can solve them in really easy manner. Picking the right quality problems is 90% of the game. We've identified two or three major areas where there's a huge amount of pain that customers have. One of them is about security and anomaly detection. The other one might be in workflows. Okay, can you have, based on a piece of metadata, can you then automatically start recommending tasks to other people or going ahead and triggering workflows? The other one is we have a product in beta right now called Feed, where you could have some kind of system that's recommending to you what content is most relevant to you and surface that up. Those are the kind of things that we're using Graph to power, and there'll be more and more experiences within Box that'll actually start using Graph. I mean, think about a governance policy engine that'll actually start using Graph over time. So you'll see all of our different products over time will actually benefit from the innovations in Graph.
Still in the subject of AI, it sounds like, as you mentioned, AI is in its early days. What you're talking about are variances of solution. Where do you see AI going next in terms of that next level of AI?
Today, what you have is content repositories. The flow that you have is you will typically search for a document and then get the document, open it up, go out and find the answer that you're looking for in the document. Over time, I think you might just ask a question and get an answer. A document just becomes a knowledge base. And then he's saying, when is this particular product feature shipping? And then the document will know my permission set. It'll know the documents that it needs to go out and look that from. And then based on natural language, it'll give me back a response that it's shipping on October 15th. That is the ultimate use of AI is, you know, you just start to have this very unique response back from what you're talking about. This is not something that happens in the next quarter or two, but that is the ultimate vision, is that you just take out all the friction from people and make sure that the extraction of knowledge from the content gets to be as painless as possible through AI.
I cover some different sectors, including ERP, and there's one vendor that looks at facial recognition and uses facial recognition. So when people walk into their office, they know who it is, they clock them in, they can do all their timesheeting for them. Do you see that interaction to say, I walked in today into the Box office and I had to take my photo, tell the system who I was. Over time, in theory, I should be able to walk into the Box office. Box will know this is me and it knows I've got a meeting with you, and therefore it'll flag it automatically and I won't need to register and do things. Do you see that coming at some point?
There are going to be systems that use Box as an underlying content fabric where it is their job to create those registration systems, and they will use us as a feed into that mechanism. So you start seeing our Box platform capabilities used quite a bit over there, where we will white label our capability into other custom applications that get built. You will also have a level of experience enhancement that happens in our own native products with AI. The things that we talked about, you ask a question, get an answer, you have trigger workflows that get automated. Like, imagine a very common use case that I walk into a meeting and the system already knows that this is the document where you should be taking notes because it has your calendar data, and then it actually merges that together, and so it just opens up that for you and you don't have to go out and do that much. I think that would be a very logical thing for someone like Box to do. So over time, those are the kind of capabilities that you'll see more and more built out, is on two domains. One is custom applications that get built. How can we act as a underlying infrastructure to provide that capability to them so that those applications get more and more sophisticated? You as a user might never know that Box is powering some of those things. And then you also have our first-party apps and our integrations with third-party vendors where we'll make those richer and richer over time.
Arguably, you could imagine the situation where you walk into a meeting and Box understands who's in the meeting, takes the notes from the meeting itself, categorizes them, and then produces the minutes.
Absolutely. Yeah, that could happen. There's two areas where we have to be careful in this. And AI fundamentally has changed the software development process quite a bit. This is probably worth talking about. Historically, the way that software got built was you identified a problem, identified features you had to build, and then it was just a matter of building the features. With AI, it doesn't quite work that way. With AI, you have a model that you train against a piece of data, and then you see how it does, and it's a completely non-deterministic approach where it doesn't work, doesn't work, doesn't work, doesn't work, and suddenly one day it does. The ethical quandaries around AI are the ones that we need to be very concerned about and think about. So like our beta cycles with anything that has AI tend to take far longer than the ones that don't, because you want to be careful of making sure that I think it's the responsibility of software companies that unintended consequences don't occur with the product that you're building. Software historically has taken a very simplistic approach. Disruption is good. I'm going to go ahead and innovate some stuff, and there's going to be largely good things that happen with and some bad things that happen. And for some bad things that happen, you can't really build something that doesn't have some bad consequence to it. You build automobiles and there are car accidents. Are you not going to build automobiles? And that was a very simplistic view. I think we're in a much more nuanced world today where you, the supplier, have also got to be responsible for things that might get misused that you might not readily have thought about, because you generally, as software people, we have an optimistic view of the world, which is we can go out and change things and the world is full of possibilities. But I do think that you have to take a little bit of a more balanced negative view of the world. Or what's the worst thing that could happen with this? And let's make sure we think about that proactively rather than reactively after it's happened.
The ethical requirements of AI, and SAP recently set up a governance body basically to look at the ethics of AI. Yes. Obviously, Asimov was almost the founder in terms of the three laws of robotics. Who do you think should be responsible for this? Does Box have a stance on this? And where do you think that responsibility should lie?
I actually don't think there are clear answers yet in society around this. But what I will say to you is the following, which is, firstly, one job that will not be taken away and, in fact, will be created in the world of AI is a chief ethics officer. Another job that will actually be one that humans will have to do is figuring out the inherent bias that AI algorithms can have. Because one of the things about AI is you can do at scale things that humans use judgment to do. When you do it at scale and the bias seeps in at scale, that can actually be far more dangerous than actually having humans do it. There's a 10x scale processing throughput component, 100x, 1000x, a 1000000x scale processing in a capability that AI has. Assessing the bias of models and algorithms in AI is actually going to be very, very crucial as you move forward. Who owns the responsibility? I think it'll depend. It's not clear. I'll give you an example in a different industry. In the automobile industry, we talk about this concept of ripple effects in society. When you might have a technology that's built in one area that might have ripple effects in ways that you might not even imagine. So imagine if there's a self-driving automobile. That's going to have massive ripple effects in insurance. That's going to have ripple effects in how you go about having your city planning done, because your parking lots might not need to be in the city and you might actually have 90% of the vehicles constantly being utilized rather than for 5% of the time they utilize and 90% of the time they're in parking garages. There's a fundamental structural shift that happens when you start actually seeing massive sea change technologies take over. As that happens, in each use case, it's going to be slightly different. If we don't all carefully think about what the implications are, and that every manufacturer of solution should think that they at least have a role to play in thinking about the negative consequence and making sure that they're having the right dialogue with the right bodies and groups of people. And I don't think it's that clear right now. I don't think the industry's figured out who's going to definitively own that, because it's not as easy. In liability of coverage, if you're in a self-driving car and you're just sitting over there and there's an accident and someone gets killed, who's responsible for that? Is it the manufacturer of the car? Manufacturer of the algorithm? Is it the person that didn't override the machine and actually take over control at some point in time? It's not that simple.
Taking that question from a slightly different angle, AI at the moment is really good at automating processes, understanding processes, and scaling those processes, which is doing more than a human is capable of. In some areas, such as pharma, it's capable of innovation, but innovation within a closed data set. It's that question of what happens when you open up those data sets to data sets that previously haven't been contemplated, and AI starts to leverage the innovation outside of that and starts almost to do the lateral thinking that humans can do. It's not quite the same, is it, though? Is that the point where the ethical boundary becomes even more blurred?
It's very important to make sure that in the short term, people, just like in anything else, I think Bill Gates was the one who had said this, that in the short term, technology is usually overestimated. In the long term, its impacts are hugely underestimated. We don't even know all the things that will come about. And anyone who pretends to think they do, I think, is just kidding themselves, because the power of exponentiality over here is so huge that literally, and the humans just have a hard time inherently thinking about exponentiality across multiple dimensions. When you start thinking about AI and medicine, that actually might change lifespans. And because the lifespan's changing, that might actually change how you need to do agriculture. And that might change how construction occurs. And that might mean that you might have seven generations that actually live simultaneously together rather than three. And then there's just a whole set of ripple effects that happen that I don't think we as humans have actually thought through. There's a very real downside of AI that we should keep in mind, which is, yes, there's a large amount of positive impact that can happen with it, but also there could be a very disruptive impact that happens, which is jobs get taken and don't get replaced, and the creation of jobs compared to the net disruption of jobs has an imbalance. Imbalance in the non-favorable manner, which is like there's less jobs getting created than the ones that have been taken away. It's very likely that that could happen with AI. So things like universal basic income might actually become a thing that gets very real in the social consequence of it over time.
Yeah, I'll get distracted from that as well about utopian societies and how jobs may get simpler.
There's some jobs which will get simpler because of repeatable tasks. You shouldn't actually have humans do that actually give them much reward, and you should have humans then focus on innate tasks which require human judgment that machines aren't as good at doing. On the other hand, there'll be jobs that we believe right now require human judgment that machines might take on. I think about my cousin and one of my best friends, they're radiologists. The definitive fact is you're not going to need as many radiologists in the next 15 years as you have today because of the fact that a lot of that task can be taken over by a machine. How does that go out and impact that industry? It still has to be determined. And I think as the adjustment happens in each code within the world, I think there's going to be some. Here's the thing that I think is a responsibility of all of us as leaders. When disruption is going to occur in a certain industry or sector, there's very few sectors that don't have disruption because of AI. Probably like childcare and nursing are the ones that will probably still remain. Everything else probably will have some level of implication of it. Things like truck drivers, huge percentage of population of the U.S., that could get disrupted pretty meaningfully. And when that happens, if you don't, as society, take collective responsibility of retraining that workforce, that's when you start creating very dangerous societal consequences for things. And I think it is our responsibility jointly to make sure that not only do we go out and continue to keep innovating, but when disruption happens as a byproduct of innovation, that we're actually taking responsibility for the disruption and creating a level of retraining mechanism for society so that they can get back on their own feet. Because if you have someone who's 55 that worked in the coal mining industry in the Midwest in the U.S., and all of a sudden at 55 they don't have that job anymore because that industry got disrupted, their next job isn't the simplistic narrative that Silicon Valley has, which is going to be, I'm going to be an AI developer. You don't go from coal mining to AI development. There's a retraining that needs to happen for that individual to be able to get a job, or they hit rock bottom. And collectively, we owe it to humanity to make sure that we do that effectively.
That's a very pertinent point, especially as we're now at the inflection point of the US in terms of energy, where green energy is now cheaper to produce than coal energy. So it is highly likely that coal mines are going to start shutting down over the next few years.
And by the way, when that happens, the narrative should not be we should have more coal mines for longer. It just means that we should make sure that we retrain the people so that they're installing solar roofs more frequently, and that those are the kind of things that they're retraining the workforce for.
There is another problem with AI coming in, and this is around what I see as the education pyramid. And I've seen it in software development, I mean, worked as a CIO, is that as software becomes more sophisticated, the developers are now working at higher levels of applications. They're working in 4GL. They're working more in clicks rather than underlying code, but they're certainly not working in assembler at the core level. What that means is they have a reliance on the language they're using, and they don't necessarily understand what lies behind that language. You end up having the bottom of the pyramid knowledge lost to the vast majority of people now working. AI is going to enhance that problem. So how do we ensure that people don't just understand the technology that they're using today, but actually understand the technology that makes that technology?
Not just the surface level, but how do you go deeper? It's a very interesting question, because if you think about the total number of humans that will be exposed to some kind of conditional programming in the next 20 years, it's going to be far greater than the number of humans that do it today. I sit on the board of a company called HackerRank. They have a lot of data around how recruiting happens for developers. And it's just fascinating to see the trends that are starting to change over there. You'll just see that there's going to be many, many more developers from very early ages in life start becoming developers. And developers is not going to just be a thing that you just learn to program because you want to be a coder. You might learn to program because that becomes a skill that you have, just like knowing math to get by in life. On the other hand, if you start getting too abstracted and there's not enough depth of knowledge, those people will, I think in some way, in that particular area, demand and supply take care of it, because you will always need people that need to have the next level of technical detail. Those people will be disproportionately rewarded. As a result of it, there's always going to be an inherent societal incentive to go out and learn that level of depth for a certain select few people. I don't worry about that problem as much as I do about the problem of what the ethical misuse and the privacy misuse. We have a customer, Oxfam. We had a customer advisory board meeting recently, and she came to us and she was talking to us about privacy. The one reason that we use Box is not because privacy is, we think, important. It's because in our business, which is they go out and help with refugee camps in different parts of the world, and they help with the disaster scenarios. If privacy is violated in an area that has genocide, people die. It's not just, oh, this is a thing for the elite to say, well, is my privacy being really violated when I actually was out with my girlfriend and got photographed and the paparazzi? That's a very different kind of privacy protection that you need. If someone's identity got revealed in the wrong way and there was genocide going on in that area, you literally die. And do you want to be responsible for that death? That actually even gives us a moment of pause saying, well, every single thing that happens in Box has just an accentuated impact on society as a level of, we are going to inherently become more and more of an indirect society, where the things you do, you might have not thought about, the way that other people use them will actually have consequence to society.
We talked about megatrends, you've gone through cloud, mobile, AI. How do you spot them?
Most people think that megatrends get spotted by a couple of visionaries in a company that'll identify where the puck is going, and then they decide that. My experience has been exactly the opposite, which is, I'm sure Steve Jobs might have been good at that, but most of us aren't Steve Jobs. And for the rest of us, outside of those Einsteins or Steve Jobs in the world, what I've found is it's a very organic process that's iterative, that actually is very bottoms up. What you have to do is construct your organization in such a way that people don't lose their agility as you get scale. We have this concept of two pizza teams that we use pretty carefully, which is Amazon pioneered this, where don't construct teams that are more than can be fed with two pizzas. What that does is it actually makes sure that the teams stay agile and there's a lot of frequency of communication between the members of the team where everyone's on the same page. Because the moment you get to 30, 40 people in a team, most of the time is spent in just keeping people aligned rather than innovating. How you spot these megatrends is having people have a level of autonomy and thinking deeply about a problem that they care about that they can personally relate with. And if you can construct those teams and then have some kind of governance model where you can have discussions about what they're doing and pressure test some of the ideas that they have, you get magic to happen. And that's at least the way that we've spotted most of our trends. I don't think it's Aaron and me sitting in a room saying, okay, this is where the world is going to go. I think it's usually a collective dialogue with us and the teams that are thinking about these issues that bring about most of the genius. And 99% of the genius comes from the people, not from us.
Is there a next megatrend beyond AI?
There's a lot. There's implications of how this is going to be in process automation. If you think about what will happen in the long term with blockchain and currency, there's a fair number of megatrends. Like, we might not participate in every single one of those megatrends, but AI seems to be the consequential one for us over the next decade. But robotics, autonomy and driving, RPA, there's blockchain. These are all very, very meaningful trends that are going to fundamentally change society than the way that we know it today.
Before we start recording, we talked about battery power. And are there any technologies that you see potentially really fundamentally changing things? Battery power, from my point of view, being one of them.
Battery power, I think, has massive implications, especially on the storage side of the house. If you had storage technology at a different curve today compared to what it was, if we were farther along in the storage technology, I think climate change could be in a very different area as well, because everything changes once you have more storage. Right now, what you're starting to see is the level of persistence with natural generated energy actually gets to be better and better as battery power is increasing. Even in day-to-day conveniences, the number of devices we have and how frequent we have to charge them. Like, we were just talking about this before we got started, but the Apple Watch, it's a great product. I use it every day. I love it. I've got to put it on the charger every night. When we get that to, once you charge it once a month, when you get that to the point that solar charges it and you never have to charge it, those are going to be meaningful, discontinuous things. And we get to the fact that I don't have to charge my electric car by plugging it in, but my solar energy can charge it, or when I'm driving on the road, it starts charging it. I think you'll see quality of life continue to keep improving. So I think there's a fair amount of implications. The other one that will actually impact a lot is also one area that people don't pay enough attention to is water. These are all massive megatrends that will have implications on the next billion people. But certainly, I dabble in those, but wouldn't consider myself an expert. Like, the area that I know a lot about is in the content space and how that's going to have an implication.
Thank you very much, G2.
Thank you for your time.